From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today, Whole Foods moved to Detroit on a mission to help change the way people in poverty eat. But has that worked?
Going for the cheapest item in each category, you would see your grocery bill go up by about, I think it was 27%.
Plus, why are so many black-majority communities under emergency management?
The ability of a young man, sometimes a young woman, to graduate from high school and get a pretty high-paying job and to sustain a medium, middle-income living style, that has just disappeared.
Then the immigration debate from a woman's perspective.
I wanted to humanize immigration and to tell powerful stories and have people understand why people come here and what they get out of being here and what we get of them being here.
Those stories and more. When Whole Foods opened in Midtown Detroit, there was applause from some and questions from others.
What's interesting about what Whole Foods is doing is they're trying to redefine health to basically require you to shop at their store.
I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today, lessons from the Whole Foods expedition to Detroit 1 year on. But first, when voters went to the ballot to kill the emergency manager law, the legislature responded in the lame duck session. It passed a new emergency manager law and made sure no voter initiative in the future would remove it. The governor signed that. Well, opponents sued on several claims, but a federal judge recently ruled against those claims, except for one. It alleged racial discrimination. That's because 52% of the state's African-American population is now under emergency managers in various communities. Only 2% of white residents live under emergency managers. With us to discuss why so many minority communities find their local governments and school districts in bad financial shape is University of Michigan Professor Reynolds Farley. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to make it clear, though, before we start, there are some white majority communities just as financially stressed, but they don't have emergency managers. That would be a red flag right there. I want to discuss, though, why so many black majority communities are struggling the way they are. What's happened to them that would mean they can't deal with basic government and school district finances?
The explanation is really quite straightforward. In 1970, there was a substantial blue-collar population in the black community sustained largely by manufacturing jobs in the automobile industry. Those jobs have decreased greatly in number. They have not disappeared, but the ability of a young man, sometimes a young woman, to graduate from high school and get a pretty high-paying job and to sustain a medium, middle-income living style, that has just disappeared. It certainly has affected very many white people in the state of Michigan, but we still are a state with moderate, although declining, levels of segregation. But wherever you have large concentrations of African Americans, very many of them have suffered in the restructuring of employment in recent years. And that's a key cause of this pattern of emergency financial managers in black cities and black school districts.
I recall one time you told me that, yes, the typical job, blue-collar job for a black male in the 70s was automobile industry. But today, the largest employer of African-American workers is in fast food restaurants. That's got to have a terrible effect on the family's bottom line.
It certainly does. It was the case that back in 1970, the typical employed black person in Michigan was working in manufacturing, and today they're working in the fast food industry.
So that means they're less likely to be homeowners. They're less likely to be able to afford real estate taxes. They're not making much in income taxes, or at least a lot less. That's all going to affect the bottom line of local government and local school districts, right?
Absolutely. Those who do own their own homes are going to have a very hard time paying the property tax on those homes. There's going to be a lot of foreclosures. They're not going to be buying a lot of retail goods, so sales tax revenue is going to decrease. It is a difficult time for the traditional blue-collar middle class in Michigan, but particularly for African Americans who have not gone on to college at quite the same rates whites have.
Let's talk about Detroit for a second, because that was the largest municipality under an emergency manager. That emergency manager is now gone. We have a settlement in the bankruptcy case. But they're still going to be struggling because so few
black men are able to find jobs in Detroit. You cited to me one time, well, I know that the unemployment rate in Detroit in August officially was 14.6%. That's almost double Michigan's 7.4%. But that doesn't really tell the whole story among adult black males.
No. In recent years, among adult black men in Michigan, not much more than 50% of them have been employed. This is very, very different from what it was in 1970. Jobs are not out there. And jobs, including the jobs in manufacturing, are paying less than they paid in real terms 30 or 40 years ago.
So even if you're lucky enough to have a job, say at Detroit Manufacturing Systems, sure, where I know they're paying a starting wage of $10 per hour, it goes up from there, but that's a union shop, and they're paying $10 per hour, which is not what UAW used to pay at Chrysler or GM.
Absolutely.
Or
the starting wages used to be in the low 20s, and even in the big three now, the entry wages are close to $16, $17 an hour. So there's been a very big cutback in the wages paid to manufacturing workers. At the same time in Detroit, in Flint, Pontiac, and other places with large African-American populations, there has been some growth of the middle-class black population. They used to find it impossible to move to the suburbs, but thank goodness we've had a civil rights revolution, and the suburbs around Detroit and these other cities are quite open, so the middle-class black population in many of these towns has moved out, further making further difficulties for raising taxes and getting tax revenue in these cities.
Now, as this discrimination allegation or claim goes through the federal courts, it might or might not have some kind of effect on policy eventually. I think, though, looking at the fact that so many black Americans are under emergency managers, and some of those cities were no worse or better than so many white cities, it seems like there's quite a case there. But I'm wondering, in the long term, what's the policy answer here? What should the people in Lansing be doing about this situation where so many black-majority towns are driven to the point where the state steps in with an emergency manager?
We should think here in Michigan about having one standard property tax rate that would apply throughout the entire state. And the revenue from that property tax would be distributed to municipalities primarily on the basis of their population size. After the Kalkaska schools went broke in March of 93, the state moved in that direction with regard to supporting public education.
With Prop A. Right?
Yes.
Which has been more or less better than we had, but still got a lot of
problems.
Prop
A has a lot of troubles, and there certainly are school districts with great difficulties, but there is a statewide base to educate our students. There's no reason we couldn't have a statewide property tax and allocate it on the basis of population size. And then we need to think about the number of suburban governments or urban governments. Around Detroit, there are about 124 suburban municipalities, each competing with the city of Detroit. Some reduction in that number would save taxpayers in the long run quite a bit of money.
So consolidation there and a flattened real estate
yes.
tax. How do you think the wealthier white communities would feel about some of their tax dollars being evened out and maybe they wouldn't have the same kind of city services they had before?
With regard to schools, school districts have some ability to impose taxes for frills and new schools and extra services. Similarly, that might be possible if we had one statewide tax rate on property. I'm sure, though, there would be a lot of opposition, and it would not be politically easy to innovate a statewide property tax or to get merge out of existence some of the many communities that are probably too small to continue in existence.
That's Reynolds Farley. He's a professor at the Population Studies Center and of Sociology at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty, there's a new video documentary that looks at immigration from a woman's perspective.
I chose to come here because I didn't want to be a typical Indian wife.
I embrace the fact that I'm Australian. Like, I know I'm Australian. I love that about my existence. But for me, it's not mutually exclusive that if just because you live somewhere else, that therefore you lose your identity of where you came from.
I get the question of like, oh, was Spain? Spain's such a wonderful country. I'm like, yes, Spain's a lovely country. But as a woman, I would not be able to do what I'm doing right now.
My life is duplicated in two countries. I have a community of friends, some so close that they're like family to me. And in South Africa, I have my friends that whenever I come back, it's like I've never left.
That's the trailer from the film Vanishing Borders. It was directed and produced by a teacher at Michigan State University. Alexandra Hidalgo is an assistant professor in the Department of Writing, Rhetoric, and American Cultures, and she joins us now. So the opening scene of the film is of four friends coming together to share a meal. Each is from a different part of the world, each an immigrant to the United States, and the conversation starts with discussion about small cultural differences. It kind of eases the viewer into this larger discussion. How did you find these women, and what made you think, ah, these are the people who would make a good documentary?
One of the women, Melanie Rogers, has been a friend of mine for, oh my God, now 14 years. Teboho Moja, I had known briefly. I had worked at NYU while my husband was getting his degree there, and I had seen her, and I thought, oh my God, this is such an amazing woman. Somebody needs to make a movie about her. And then Daphne and Yatna came out of, I don't know, 200 emails that I sent out and phone calls. And I had lived in New York for 2 years, so I had a big community of friends there. And everybody I knew helped me try to find women for this documentary. So that's how they came into the picture. And the things that I was looking for were compelling stories and people who could be eloquent and who were not afraid of the camera. I think one of the images that people have of immigrants is that, you know, they can't speak the language and they can't express themselves well. And I wanted to show that there are immigrants who can certainly speak in profound and intelligent ways. So that was one of the things that I was looking for.
Now, we learn a lot about Yatna, Melanie, Teboho, and Daphne as each of their backstories are revealed. Tell us a little bit about where each person is from and how they arrived in the United States.
Yatna is from India, and she came to the States because her husband was working here. So she married, then she had to wait 11 months for her visa to go through, and then she came over to the States. Daphne was born in Ecuador, and her mother is Peruvian and her father is Spanish. And when she was a teenager, she came to the United States from Spain, where she had grown up. She had an abusive mother, and that was one of the reasons why she came, but she also has a learning disability, and the U.S. had really good support for that, so that's the reason why she came. She came to live with her grandmother. Melanie came to the States to study nutrition. She's from Australia. She came to study in the United States at NYU. She got her master's in nutrition. And then Teboho Moja is from South Africa. And Teboho originally came to study in Wisconsin, and then she ended up coming back as, you know, a faculty member at New York University.
Yeah, their personal stories, as you reveal them, some of them are quite moving. What are you hoping people take away as they hear these backstories?
I think it's important for us to understand that immigrants are human beings with really powerful stories, and that immigration benefits both places. It benefits both sets of people, the people who immigrate and the people who have the immigrants come into their towns. So one of the things that I'm hoping that people understand is just how beneficial immigration is for both parties. It doesn't mean that it's perfect. It doesn't mean that there are no issues whatsoever, no pain or no loss, but immigration really enriches the immigrant and it enriches the people around them. And I'm also just hoping to humanize immigration. I think we tend to talk about immigration in numbers and we get a sense of immigrants as this abstract threat and they're coming to get us and they're ruining our economy and they're taking all our jobs and they're criminals. And I wanted to show that that is not necessarily the case, and it's definitely not the case for most immigrants. So I wanted to humanize immigration and to tell powerful stories and have people understand why people come here and what they get out of being here and what we get of them being here.
each woman is close to her country of origin, but at the same time, each has a really strong reason for leaving, and it wasn't always economic reasons. Why was it important to you to tell those sometimes hard-to-hear stories about how they arrived here?
Because I think very often people don't understand why people leave their country's origins. There's a bit of like, oh, they just want to come here and take our jobs and become rich. And people have sometimes very compelling reasons for having to leave the place where they were born. And I think the more we hear these personalized stories, the more we'll be compassionate towards those people who are doing those things, and the more we'll understand that it's sometimes they don't have a choice, or sometimes they have a choice, but this is a place where they can better express their creativity or their intellectual power or their political activism.
I was really moved by Taboho's story. Tell me a little bit about why she ended up in the United States.
Taboho originally came to the United States to escape the issues in South Africa. She grew up during apartheid, and she was very politically involved with the anti-apartheid movement. And she ended up coming to the States in a way to sort of save herself and her family, because she was certain, quite like she was on the either get arrested or get killed list. She talks about how coming here, she realized that the world wasn't just about black versus white. You know, it brought her this whole other understanding of the way that race relations could take place and how enriching it could be to have friendships and interactions with people from other races. So I think she came to escape, but then she ended up getting a much deeper sense of who she wanted to be and how she could interact with others.
Tell me about the title, Vanishing Borders. What does that mean to you?
It's funny. I'm terrible with titles. Titles are not my my forte. So we that was actually proposed by Taboho. It's like, what are we going to call this movie? And she had written a paper. She had published something that was called Vanishing Borders. So she was like, oh, let's call it that. And I thought, yes, thank you. Finally, a title that works. One of the things that's happening and is that immigration is happening all over the world. So the borders are vanishing not just in the States, not just in certain countries. They're vanishing everywhere. And I think we have become a globalized world, and we need to think about that, and we need to sort of make sense of what that means for us as human beings. So I'm hoping that that argument gets made by the documentary, and that's why where the title comes from.
One of the things I noticed is each of the women talk about opportunities in the U.S. that she could never have had in her own home country. But at the same time, each saw inequalities that she wanted to help change or make better in the United States. Why was that perspective important to you?
Because I think it's important for us to understand why these people are coming here. And there are amazing opportunities that we have here. But it's also important for us to understand these people who are not from here can see things that we're not seeing. They grew up elsewhere, and they have a way to look at what we can't find ourselves. So what is their perspective? What are they finding? And what solutions are they proposing to the problems that we might not even know we have, or problems that we know we have but we haven't been able to solve? So it was interesting to me to show their perspectives on what it's like to see this culture from both the outside and the inside, right? Because the immigrant has that. At first, you're an outsider, and then you become more of an insider, but you're always straddling both worlds. So I wanted to see what kind of critiques these women had on this of our country based on that wonderful vantage point that they have of belonging to two worlds, or more sometimes for some of them.
Right. Where and how is this film going to be released, and who do you hope to reach?
So we are submitting this film to festivals right now, and then it will go from there. However, it's very important for us, because of the message of the film, for it to be screened at immigrant organizations and also by women's groups. So one of the things that we're hoping is that we can have community screenings by these groups, and I'm always glad to either come in if it's local or to Skype in and talk to people, because I think another audience that we're really hoping to reach are immigrants themselves. So it was important for us to create these stories and to have immigrants see it so that it helps them understand what they themselves are bringing into their country or how their stories compare to these. So we're hoping that before we get distribution and before we do all these things, we would like to have organizations and women's groups watch it.
Alexandra Hidalgo is the director and producer of the film Vanishing Borders. She's also an assistant professor at Michigan State University. Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Collaboration.
Innovation.
The next idea.
The world doesn't stop. The world continues to change. So we as people need to change along with it.
We're back with The Next Idea, our new project that examines new ways of doing things that could help shape Michigan's future. It's the holiday shopping season, and you're probably being bombarded with the message, buy more. Your loved ones deserve it. Do your part to stimulate the economy. Just keep buying. Yet, ever-growing economic development greatly depends on ever-diminishing resources. Every innovation that hits the market, the next big thing that everybody must have, is not necessarily going to make anybody any happier. And that's the subject of our latest Next Idea essay from Rex Lamore. Rex is the director of Michigan State University Center for Community Economic Development. He looked at this idea that making and selling more goods is necessary for economic growth. He argues we need to re-examine that notion, and he joins us now. So you start out this essay stating the idea that innovation is critical to achieving economic and societal success should be parsed a little. What are we missing?
Right. Every year in the fall in particular, I go through this sort of soul-searching, because part of my responsibility here at Michigan State is to teach environmental planning to our planning students. And on the other side, I do economic development as director of the Center for Community and Economic Development. So I'm very aware of this unending drumbeat of buy more, consume, the GNP is growing, how many people shopped this week, what did Black Friday look like as far as turnout, how much consumer expenditures were going on, is the economy growing, are we doing better or not? And on the other hand, I see the environmental indicators of our continual use of non-renewable resources, our environmental footprint as a consumption-based economy, the implications that has on everything from global climate change to other indicators of pollution. And I kind of go, wow, are you sure this is what it's all about? Is it about buying more stuff and having more stuff and giving more stuff? And what is the likely end of that in a world that isn't finite, limited resources?
You state the way our economy works right now, we need to sell more and more goods for economic growth. And I know retailers measure success by year-over-year sales, and anything but higher sales, sometimes anything less than double-digit percentages, is seen as failure. How sustainable is that?
Well, it would appear to be unsustainable for any extended period of time. Eventually, we're going to the extent that those products rely on particularly non-renewable resources, we're going to find ourselves in a scenario where we've used them all up and they're no longer available for the new, innovative, whatever the next particular thing is.
Now, I want to clear something up. You're not saying economic development is bad, are you?
Well, economic growth that does not also bring along social and environmental attributes, positive elements like reducing inequality or bringing more balance to our relationship to the environment, is probably not the best that we could do. So it has to be mitigated with other values that are important to us.
So you suggest we should differentiate between what you call consumptive innovation and principled innovation. Break that down for us.
Yes. So the idea is that as consumers, because in this consumptive economy, we're the ultimate decision makers, that as consumers, we need to make choices about those purchases that we make And the value that they add to our lives, is it a consumptive purchase, one that just gives us more stuff, or is it a principled purchase that allows us to achieve other goals? So a principled consumption would be one that would accomplish other values other than just having more stuff.
Now, are you urging us all to do all our own homework and figure this out for ourselves, or would you like some kind of a board to recommend what's principled and what's not?
I think we're more likely to be effective if we keep it simple. So that as consumers, we look for the gold seal or we look for a rating that gives us an idea, how does this do? And, you know, like I think many of us are used to looking at the recycled materials symbol, that sort of triangle that goes in a recycled direction. And so if we had a symbol that we could look at that would give us an idea, how close does this come to being a valued consumption versus another type of consumption, then I think that would help us. And then we can make that an informed consumer decision, because that's what we're really heading towards, that informed consumer. Then as consumers, the ultimate drivers of the economy, you know, we're making the best decision for ourselves and our posterity, and then, you know, we go forward. Now, those companies that don't hit the criteria, well, they may either redo their manufacturing processes or the products that they're selling. And so, again, we use the marketplace as the tool to advance these valued principles that we have.
Rex Lamore is director of Michigan State University's Center for Community and Economic Development. You can find the essay we've been discussing at the Next Idea page on michiganradio.org. Thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome, and thanks for the opportunity to share this idea with you and your colleagues.
We try to end each conversation on the next idea with a question for all of us to discuss. So Rex Lamore suggested a seal of good innovation as a way to distinguish between innovations that improve or increase sustainability from the ones that don't. What other ideas do you have for separating sustainable innovations from the rest? And do we even need to distinguish the difference at all? Let us know your thoughts in the comments under the essay at our website, again, michiganradio.org, or on the station's Facebook page, or on Twitter at NextIdeaMI.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. When Whole Foods opened in Midtown Detroit, there was loud applause that a major grocer would serve the city. And then there were a lot of questions. Why Whole Foods? I mean, could the vast majority of Detroit even afford the upscale grocer? The management of Whole Foods indicated it would work to keep prices lower than its other stores, affordable, and noted that low-income people deserved a source of healthier food choices, too. It shouldn't be limited as an option for only the middle class or the rich. But execution of those goals has been a mixed bag of results. Tracy McMillan wrote a piece for Slate.com entitled, "Can Whole Foods Change the Way Poor People Eat?" And she joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
As I read your article, it seemed as though there were a lot of disconnects, a disconnect between why Whole Foods was encouraged to come to Detroit and its stated goals for being in Detroit, a disconnect between the city's poor, about one-third of Detroit is at or below the poverty line, and the value that Whole Foods place on its products. And then there's a disconnect between Whole Foods and the idea that all that really needs to be done is to persuade the residents of Detroit they need to change the way they eat. So let's start with that first one. Why Whole Foods came to Detroit?
I think the reason Whole Foods came to Detroit actually ties into several different themes, right? First of all, Whole Foods is looking to expand its store base, nearly tripling up to 1,200 stores by 2020. So they've got to expand past sort of the upper income niche market that it's known for serving. I think Walter Robb, the co-CEO who championed the store internally at Whole Foods, I think he is sincere in having a social conscience and wanting to figure out ways to address his concerns around social equity at the same time, right? Whole Foods is a business, and they saw this not just as a way to go in and open a store, not just even as a way to do market research for expanding other stores, but also as a very savvy way to get a lot of press. This store got a lot of national media attention when it opened, and Whole Foods isn't stupid, right? Like, they understand that their reputation as an upper-income grocer conflicts with people's understanding of Detroit, and that that was going to be sort of catnip for media. And I think that that actually did happen, right? Like, you actually got Kai Ryssdal from Marketplace to come all the way out from L.A. just to attend the opening. That doesn't happen by accident, right? That's smart marketing.
So the impression was that many of the people who are residents of Detroit, except for, people who might work in the Midtown area or in those, more wealthy enclaves in Detroit, would shop at Whole Foods. Who actually ended up shopping at Whole Foods in Midtown?
Overall, the same people that shop at Whole Foods in the suburbs are the folks who are shopping at the Detroit store, which are upper income niche customers, definitely trickling down into the middle class. I think that you do see that at the Whole Foods in Detroit. And certainly, I have seen folks in security guard uniforms and things like that in the store. The Whole Foods in Detroit is one of the only places to sort of stop in and get quick, reasonably healthy food. So it's certainly the lack of competition in the market helps Whole Foods. So a lot of folks go there, but the balance, right, of customers at Whole Foods is still upper middle class folks, as far as I could tell. It's hard to get actual numbers on the socioeconomic demographics of who's going to a store, right? You'd have to get sort of internal research from a company if they're tracking it that closely. The best that I could sort of do was ask Whole Foods about how many customers they were seeing from SNAP, right, on food stamps. And while Whole Foods was telling me, we're seeing a lot more than at our other stores, like 5-6 times as much, I had a source who knows the market pretty well and said, well, that might be true, but Whole Foods typically is seeing 1-2% of its sales from SNAP. So if we're talking 10-12% of their sales from SNAP, that's great. That's more than they get elsewhere. They're operated in a city where 38% of the residents are on SNAP. So that's a really big difference.
Right. Whole Foods likes to talk about the value of its products versus the price, but when you're on a tight budget, price really matters. How do residents respond to Whole Foods' suggestion that price is not the priority, healthy food choices are?
Well, most customers of any income class care about health, right? I think that that's really obvious from the reporting that I've done. What's interesting about what Whole Foods is doing is they're trying to redefine health to basically require you to shop at their store, right? So all the discussion around sustainable, around local, around GMO-free, all of these things, they're sort of conflating all of that with a healthy diet and suggesting that the kind of food that's being sold at King Cole, which is a grocer in the North End, or, any other store, that's actually not really healthy. So I think all shoppers across all income levels are interested, for the most part, in eating healthy. What Whole Foods is really trying to convince folks is that healthy means shopping at Whole Foods.
Right. Eggs are eggs. It might be nice that Whole Foods sells eggs that are from chickens who aren't held in cages, but for your health, an egg is an egg, right?
For the most part, yeah. The sort of proven difference in nutritional value between organic and non-organic and cage-free and non-cage-free, all that stuff, it's really, really tiny, right? Most Americans, the problem is that we're not eating enough fruits and vegetables. You can certainly get that at any store. It doesn't have to be Whole Foods.
Now, Whole Foods doesn't like to compare its prices for its products with other grocers because it's not an apples-to-apples comparison. But you did some comp shopping of your own. What did you find?
Yeah, so what I found is that if you were to switch from King Cole, which is a grocery store in the North End, sort of stable, long-term operating grocery store in Detroit, and then switch to Whole Foods, going for the cheapest item in each category, you would see your grocery bill go up by about, 27%. That's less than it would go up if you went to a Whole Foods in the suburbs. I think the increase there was more around 40%, right? So the Detroit Whole Foods is comparatively cheaper than the suburban stores. And what was really interesting to me is that, Whole Foods will trot out its items that it says are competitive, that are competitively priced. And certainly they do a great job with loss leading. Their bananas are as cheap as anywhere else in the city, spaghetti sauce, pasta sauce, things like that. But if you sit down and you sort of look at what's cheap and what's not at Whole Foods, what you'll find is that it's the processed food in the grocery aisles that's usually pretty close in price, maybe within 5, 10% of a normal grocery store. Once you start looking at the stuff like fruits and vegetables and meat and dairy and, you know, sort of fresh food, that's where Whole Foods really loses its competitive edge in pricing, which, you know, Whole Foods will tell you that's because it's organic or it's produced in all these ways. But I think it was the produce was 50% more expensive as an average, and the meat was usually close to twice as expensive at Whole Foods as at another grocery store.
Now, you presented your findings to Whole Foods management. What was the reaction?
Last January, I was having a conversation with Whole Foods co-CEO Walter Robb, and I said, hey, you know, this is great what you guys are doing, but we got to talk about prices here. And, you know, you guys are great on organic prices, but if you're going to do all your grocery shopping at Whole Foods, it's definitely more expensive. And, you know, Rob's response was, well, that's not true. We're competitive on like-to-like items. And Whole Foods isn't really willing to engage with a discussion of price beyond that talking point. They sort of talk about the value of what they're doing. They will tell you that, you know, they are competitive on a like-to-like item, but that's really as far as they're going to go. They're not going to engage with the fact that, you know, not everybody is going to be buying organic. And it's very interesting, and the more that I spent time talking with Whole Foods, you know, this piece took about 18 months. You know, the sort of more I could understand the way that their PR was working. And they have this really intelligent and savvy response that, you know, they'll sort of say, oh, we're coming to Detroit, we're going to serve all of Detroit, and we're going to have lower prices. And you say, oh, that's great, you have lower prices. And they're like, yes, and it's great value. And you say, great. And then you say, oh, but wait, these prices aren't that much cheaper. And then they say, oh, but it's not our job to tell poor people how to shop, is it, or what their values are. And it, you know, the first few times I had this discussion with Whole Foods, for me, it was really shocking sort of how immediately embarrassed I felt, because I felt, oh my gosh, I'm being racist and classist because I thought poor people wouldn't want to eat the nice food at Whole Foods. Right. And that's actually not what I was asking. Right. I was asking how affordable is it?
Right. One of those disconnects I was talking about. You know, one of the things that really alarmed me was the Whole Foods co-CEO, Walter Robb, told you that they would stop cooperating if it didn't like the direction of your reporting. I mean, that's an interesting approach to any reporter. What kind of cooperation did you get as you kept gathering information?
Yeah, probably about the first 8 to 10 months, it went really well. It was a very slow-formed piece. So, you know, it wasn't a quick turnaround news story. And so long as I kept sort of just talking along the talking points, it went fine. And, you know, this interaction I had with Rob really surprised me. I had had sort of a professional rapport with Rob before I began the story. And he'd struck me as a fairly direct and sort of honest person. And then, you know, I was sort of shocked when on the opening day of the Whole Foods store, he sat me down and he said, oh, well, I just want to let you know, if we don't like what you're doing, we're going to stop cooperating. So up until we got to the point where I was asking about prices, they were really cooperative. You know, I spoke to some top leadership besides Rob. I, you know, was allowed to walk around the store without a PR person, which was great. But as soon as I said, oh, well, actually, I wrote down prices comparing you guys to another grocer, that's when they decided they didn't want to talk to me anymore.
I found it interesting that Whole Foods hired a nutritionist to explain how and why Detroit residents should change their diet. How does that work, and what kind of reaction have residents had to that advice?
Well, I think the nutritionist at Whole Foods, Akul Wilbright, is a really fascinating character, and I think she's doing some really interesting work in Detroit. Akua, for me, really proved the fact that, you know, people of all walks of life care about their health and nutrition. You know, I write in the piece about going to a church on a summer night in Detroit, Catholic church, but largely a black parish, and I go into this meeting of 60 or 70 people who've all come out to hear her talk. And what really sort of struck me is that, you know, when we finished the lecture, they were serving refreshments and it was vegan ice cream and green smoothies and all this stuff that the parishioners themselves had made. You know, the stuff that Akua is talking about in terms of eating healthfully and, you know, more whole foods and all of that stuff, like, there's a lot of interest in and traction with that idea in low-income communities and in communities of color. You know, in Detroit, it's really easy to forget that just because it's a poor city that's mostly black, that, you know, there are still quite a lot of black people in Detroit who are not poor. There is a middle class there that crosses race lines. People are really receptive to Akua, and particularly because she can speak in not just the vernacular of healthy eating, but also, you know, the black church, right? She does a really good job of that. So I think it's really interesting in Detroit to sort of see how people respond to her, mostly folks like her, It's just that once people start crunching the numbers about what their grocery bill is going to be if they shop entirely at Whole Foods, they don't go there as frequently.
You made the statement that the problem might not be Whole Foods. The problem is really poverty. So tell me what you mean by that. Explain that.
Well, there's a lot of discussion right now in the U.S. around using food access in supermarkets as a way to combat obesity and sort of the dietary gap that exists right now between the rich and the poor in this country, which has been widening. There are a lot of initiatives around the country around healthy food initiatives and getting more supermarkets into neighborhoods. The impetus for that is always, well, access to food matters, so you can eat a healthy diet and that's going to fix the way that people eat, and that's going to lead to better health outcomes. And what I saw in spending these 18 months in Detroit was that the reason that people are eating crappy diets usually isn't because there isn't a supermarket. It's because they don't have enough money. And I wanted to make sure that that point was clear. And I also wanted to make it clear, you know, Whole Foods is doing, I think, a lot of interesting things as a grocer. It's certainly not that retailer's fault that they haven't fixed obesity in Detroit. And I wanted to make sure, you know, that there was an understanding for readers, right, that this wasn't a takedown of Whole Foods as much as it was going to be a thoughtful look at what does it mean when you say you're going to use a grocery store to solve poverty or to solve obesity.
Now, we talked about that assumption that lower income residents of Detroit, who Whole Foods said it would serve, could not afford food from the grocer, which is sometimes derisively called the whole paycheck. So was that assumption correct? Has that proven to be the case since the store has been in business in the city? And how has its approach to its customers evolved over that time?
Yeah, so there's no great way to know the income level of folks who are at the store. In looking at how many folks are going there with food stamps, right, it's probably, my estimate would be 10 to 12% of their customers are using food stamps. And, you know, that's in a city where 38% of residents are on food stamps. So they're certainly not reaching a cross-section of the city. Over time, what was interesting to me was that as I talked with store management, they said, oh, well, the store is just succeeding. It's doing really great. And we've really been expanding our product mix. And everything they told me they were doing pointed to higher income.
They had a cap on meats. They had a cap on certain other products with this idea of being affordable to residents in Detroit.
I don't think that they've raised the bottom price up too much. Like, I did notice some things like, you know, applesauce cups went from $2.99 up to $3.19 and things like that. Some of those prices have nudged back up. But the bigger thing is that, you know, when Whole Foods went into Detroit, what it did was it stopped carrying the most expensive items because they didn't want people to come in and get sticker shock. And as the store evolved and they were getting more and more requests from customers saying, like, we would like more expensive items, they started stocking them. So the top seller in bakery was a $6 cupcake. The most expensive bottle of wine is now a $48 bottle of champagne, things like that. Whole Foods in Detroit is certainly catering more to upper income folks or folks looking for a treat than it is as a basic grocery store.
Well, that was the demand. Whole Foods is known for really reaching out to the community when it was in the hiring process. It went to several neighborhood groups to help them find new hires. It's been active in the city in other ways. Can it be argued that the grocer didn't just plop a store in the middle of the city and that was that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Whole Foods does really specific and impressive community outreach whenever it opens a store. And they did that even more so in Detroit. I believe when they opened, they had 70% of their hires were directly from Detroit. I don't know where that number now sits, but they've created jobs. It's a very lively hub in the city. You know, I think that there are a lot of benefits to having that store there. The question I was asking with this piece was, you know, well, who are you actually serving and what are you actually accomplishing? I think what they've accomplished is opening a successful, sort of more upscale type grocer than the city had before. But whether that's going to actually translate into something that matters for most Detroiters, right, I think that's a very different question.
Now, Detroit is not the only place where they've placed these stores in mixed to low-income neighborhoods around the country. What are the lessons the company is learning from these experiments?
How do you market to a mixed-income community, and can you do that successfully, and how mixed can it be? Detroit is interesting, right, because it's got such a reputation of being only poor people that all Whole Foods really had to do was show up and serve the middle, upper-middle class, and people were shocked because the sort of narrative of Detroit was that there's nobody there, right? And there actually are a good number of people living there. It's still the 13th largest, I think, city in the U.S., with that, right, in Detroit, Whole Foods was learning how do you market to communities of color really directly? What kinds of price points work in a lower income city versus an upper income enclave somewhere? How much business can we attract from our other stores in the suburbs to come down if it's cheaper here? And sort of trying to figure out how do you make all of that calculus work out so that you have a productive store. They've since opened a store in Mid-City in New Orleans. That's a very mixed income area, which is very interesting. But what I've heard from folks down there is that, you know, they're a great grocer, but the price points just really aren't there, especially when you're trying to do healthy eating education in lower income communities where the presumption tends to be that healthy food is too expensive and so why bother? And so if you have Whole Foods being the primary example of where to go grocery shopping, that doesn't dispel that myth. But Whole Foods is also opening a store in Englewood in Chicago, which is a much rougher location than where Detroit's store is. So I think that's going to be very interesting watching going forward.
Tracy McMillan wrote a piece called Can Whole Foods Change the Way Poor People Eat for Slate.com. Well worth the read. You should look it up and find it. Thanks very much, Tracy.
Thank you so much.
Stateside's executive producer is whipcracker Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Zach Dieterman, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.